This is lecture number 11 by Alan McCrae on the prophecies of Daniel. Lecture number 11. The assignment for today is to look at certain verses and briefly answer the following questions. The first question was, quote, do these verses have any bearing on the critical theory? End quote. I spoke about that last week, and I want to reiterate it again. The critical theory is that the prediction in Daniel is written to make it look like he is looking forward to these four kingdoms that we have discussed, but that he actually came late, that is, the writer came late in the time of the third kingdom, as you notice on the sheet there. I haven't shown when the third kingdom ends or when the fourth kingdom begins, because you know the third kingdom was divided into sections, and the Romans eventually took over each section at a time, over a space of about 50 years. But the critical theory is that the book of Daniel was not written by Daniel, but a later writer who took the name of Daniel and wrote 300 years after Daniel's time. He wrote at the time of Antiochus IV in order to make the Jews fight valiantly against Antiochus by claiming to give predictions that God was going to deliver them. So in the book, when it looks forward to Antiochus IV, actually the writer, according to the critical theory, is giving history while pretending it is prophecy. And when the writer goes beyond Antiochus IV, it is purely guessing on his part. Now that's the critical theory, which, of course, is utterly inconsistent with any belief that this is actually written by Daniel and that the book belongs to part of God's word. There are many small arguments that the critics have given, but most of them have been well answered. But there is a big point that I have mentioned in class before. This is the fact that the critics run into a serious obstacle by what is described by the four kingdoms. Then after the four kingdoms, when you look at Daniel as it is written, Daniel describes the great crisis in chapter 7. There are the four kingdoms in chapter 7, and then a great crisis. And then in chapter 2, there are four kingdoms, and then a description of what all the kingdoms represent. Whereas Antiochus 3 comes at the end of the third kingdom, and the critics say that the author of Daniel gives a marvelously accurate picture of history between Nebuchadnezzar and his time, claiming that it is prophecy. He did not make a serious mistake in this, claim the critics, because there were only three kingdoms. And so they say that the writer imagined that between the Babylonian kingdom and the Persian kingdom, there was an empire that one would call the Median Empire, that is, the Empire of the Medes. On the other hand, we read in Daniel chapter 5, verse 25, that Daniel says to King Belshazzar, and I'm quoting here, your kingdom is given to the Medes and the Persians, end quote. He put the Medes and the Persians together as one group. And then in chapter 6, in three cases no less, it speaks of the law of the Medes and the Persians. We would not speak now that you would have to obey the law of Great Britain and the United States. It's one or the other. Great Britain controlled this country until 1776, and then the United States gained its own control. But here we find the law of, quote, the Medes and the Persians, end quote. And then again in chapter 8, verse 20, it says, speaking of the animal that Daniel described as making a great conquest, quote, these are the kings of Media and Persia, end quote. Then in chapter 10, verse 1, Daniel refers to Cyrus, king of Persia, and in chapter 11, verse 2, still in Daniel's lifetime, there are yet three kings of Persia. So there are all these evidences that there was no kingdom of the Medes in between. The Medes were a scattered group of tribes over which there was a sort of general authority, held to which the Persians were subject for a time, but over which they gained supremacy before the end of the Babylonian Empire. Now, here was the second question, and I quote again, do these verses prove anything about the place of the kingdom in Daniel 8 in relation to those in Daniel 2 and Daniel 7, end quote. Now, one or two thought this word place here referred to the geographical situation. I gave you an assignment some time ago in which I asked you to look at the beginning of chapter 8 and to see if you could tell which of the four kingdoms these verses were related to. And that is what I meant here. The place of the kingdom of Daniel 8 in relation to Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7. Because in Daniel chapter 8, the kingdoms are specifically named. One is the king of Media and Persia, and the other is the king of Greece. These are specifically named, and someone asked, and I quote here, we learn that only from the history, don't we? In other words, we learn about these two kings only from history, don't we? End quote. And it was the end of class, and I was a little tired, I guess, and I said, yes, I should have said no, however. I should have said, you learn it from these verses in chapter 8, that there are two empires and what they are, and these will be in the assignment 3 weeks from now. But as you notice, the verses make it clear that it was the Persians who succeeded the Babylonians and the Greeks that succeeded the Persians. Therefore, chapter 8 is speaking about the two middle kingdoms and says nothing about the first, except it tells about his great conquest, but it doesn't say anything of the conquest. It does but imply that, and it does not refer to the fourth kingdom at all. Now, the current assignment is this. In Daniel chapter 9, verses 25 to 26, the word Messiah occurs twice. What does the Hebrew word represent? Now, of course, those who have had Hebrew, or have had much Hebrew, can easily look it up in their Hebrew Bible. But if you're lazy, you can just look up the word Messiah in Young's Concordance. If there are different words that are translated Messiah in the King James Version of the Bible, Young's will give these words with an English transliteration of the Hebrew word. It gives you the references, and you can easily see there what Hebrew words are used for Messiah in these places. Then, if you have a Hebrew concordance or have access to one, you can look up this Hebrew word and see all the cases where it is used. Now, if you wish, however, you can look up this Hebrew word in the back of Young's Concordance. You can do that as the words are arranged with English letters, so they are easy to look up even if you don't know any Hebrew. There you can see how many different ways this word, this Hebrew word, is translated in the Old Testament. For instance, if the word says is translated Messiah twice and translated God five times, those are two ways the word is translated. In such a case, you would have to decide from the context which of the two was right or whether in some way they represented two different phases of the same idea. So the assignment continues. How many times is this word Messiah used in the Old Testament? In how many ways does the King James Version render the word into English? List the verses where it occurs. You can easily get them out of the Hebrew Concordance or out of Young's Concordance. You can also get them out of Strong's Concordance if you wish, but that takes a little bit longer. So list the verses where the word Messiah occurs, and after each reference, state whether it refers to a prophet, a priest, a king, or something else. You should be able to tell at a glance in each case, I believe. And then count the references in each category. Now, of course, if there are some that you're not sure of as the antecedent to the word Messiah, just mark them with a question mark. And then one further question. Does the term ever apply to a non-Israelite? If so, where? This takes almost longer to give the assignment than you will find the time necessary to actually do the assignment, but I have the assignment on the bulletin board so you can look at it if you don't understand exactly what I'm aiming at from what I said. Now, we are speaking about chapter 11 in Daniel. Chapter 11 has much in it that is rather difficult to understand as to precisely what it means. And there are two reasons for this. The first reason is because the prophecy relating to future events is not given with real details. That is to say, these prophecies are not totally explicit. Now, you take the prophecies of Jesus in the New Testament, and it says, for example, this was done that it might be fulfilled. But in most cases, you can see how it has been fulfilled, but you wouldn't in advance be able to predict how this prophecy would be fulfilled by the coming of Jesus. And so these predictions, which are not figurative, but in plain language, yes, some of it is a bit vague in the predictions of the future, but it was not given to satisfy the curiosity of the future. It is given so that people can see what the prophet really said from God. And so we notice how the statement about Seleucus or Seleucus was fulfilled in verse 5. So Seleucus was called the conqueror, literally. He was called that in his lifetime, and later they called him Seleucus or Seleucus the First. Again, I remind you that Seleucus and Seleucus, those names are used interchangeably. But we read how he was prince of the Ptolemaic king of the south. But he became stronger than Ptolemy and had a great dominion. And so we have that about Seleucus, and that was predicted 300 years in advance. You couldn't tell at the time what was going to happen. But when we see it happen, we know that if the words had they been stated differently, this prophecy would not have been fulfilled. Then we notice number 2 of the outline and Antiochus II, and that was a striking event, an event in which everyone in Syria and in Egypt was aware of what happened. I don't think you could have told beforehand exactly what was going to happen, however. Now, notice in verse 6 it says, quote, "In the end of years they will join themselves together," end quote. In other words, there is a space of time between here, and that skips over Antiochus I completely and goes to Antiochus II. And Antiochus II and Ptolemy II, as your sheet shows you, were reigning at the same time. When Antiochus II was reigning, Ptolemy II was becoming an old man, for you notice that he began to reign until age 83, and Antiochus II reigned until age 61. And there had been considerable strife between these two kingdoms, and now they tried to make a treaty or alliance, and in those days they usually sealed such treaties by an intermarriage. And so, as we mentioned last time, Seleucus, who was already married to Laodice and also had a grown son, discarded Laodice and her son and married Bernice, the daughter of Ptolemy II. And as the verse says of her, quote, "The king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of the arm, nor shall he stand, nor his arm," end quote. And you remember he lived with Bernice for a brief time, and then he left her and went into Asia Minor, where his first wife, Laodice, was living. But his first wife was afraid that he would make the child of Bernice his successor, the infant child of Bernice. And so it is usually believed that Laodice poisoned her husband. And so we read, quote, "But she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begot her, and he that strengthened her in these times," end quote. And after the king died, the people who favored his son, who succeeded him, managed to get a hold of Bernice and her child and kill them. Now, this phrase, quote, "he that begot her," end quote, is usually taken to mean that Bernice's father died at just about the same time, though I notice in the New International Version that it changes this phrase to, quote, "and her son," end quote, and bases that on the ancient translation of the Septuagint and Latin Vulgate, which render it that way. That is to say, quote, "he who begot her," end quote, is translated as, quote, "he who was begotten by her," end quote, that is, her son, who was killed right along with Bernice. Whichever way you take it, however, you see that it fits with what happened. And then number 3 of the outline, we go down to Egypt, and in verse 7 to 9, we read, quote, "And out of a branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate," end quote. Now, the phrase, "in his estate," suggests that it refers to her father's estate, and it goes along with, quote, "he that begot her," end quote. Well, we read again, quote, "He shall stand up in his place, a branch of her root," end quote. In other words, her brother, Ptolemy III, and he made a great attack against the north. And we read in verses 7 to 9, in which his armies went through a great part of the empire, and he took a great amount of booty, and he carried it south with him, and he continued more years than the king of the north. Ptolemy III outlived both Seleucus II and Seleucus III. Then we have the second son of Seleucus II, who is named Antiochus III. And as I mentioned last time, Antiochus III was one of the great conquerors of antiquity. 11 verses are devoted to the history of Antiochus III. As far as we are concerned, the interest of these events is that, though it would be pretty hard to tell in advance what they predicted, it is easy to see that these verses touch on most of the events of Antiochus III's reign. They touch upon these events in the order which they occur. We will not take much time about that now. By the way, I have been asked if someone would like to look further into this matter. On this material, that is up to Antiochus IV, there is no difference of opinion between conservatives and liberals. Conservatives believe that it is a remarkably accurate prediction that Daniel had of events made up to that time of Antiochus IV. Liberals believe that it is a remarkably accurate picture of what occurred, but that it was written by someone who already knew what had happened. That is, it was history, not prophecy. But if you are interested in the details of the history at this time that goes beyond what we have time to do in class, almost any extensive commentary on Daniel will narrate them to you, whether it be a liberal commentary or a conservative commentary. There will be no difference on this particular section as to what occurred historically. Now, there are a number of books on the history of Persia. The most extensive I know is one by Bevan called, quote, "The House of the Seleucids," end quote, which I have used a considerable amount of. But we better not take too much time on the history of Antiochus III, given in the 11 verses of chapter 11 of Daniel. Now, I want to point out two or three matters about this time period. I believe I mentioned last time that Palestine and southern Syria had belonged to Egypt for 150 years. And Antiochus III, in addition to spending 15 years conducting expeditions to the east and reestablishing the control that Seleucus I had made over the area Alexander had conquered, right to the borders of India, in addition to that, he fought with Ptolemy of Egypt and he took away from him Palestine and southern Syria. He took them and annexed them to his own territory. We read in verse 14, quote, "In those days many shall stand up against the king of the south. Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish position, but they shall fail," end quote. And that is usually taken to mean that there were Jews in Palestine who were not satisfied with the generally decent ways in which they had been treated by the Ptolemies for 150 years before, but that the Jews would feel that they would be much better off under Antiochus III, and therefore, to establish their freedom from the Ptolemies, they gave their help to Antiochus III and moved away from Ptolemy into the hands of the Syrians. But look at this. We quote, "But they shall fail," end quote, which means, of course, that their vision, their idea of how much better they would be under the Antiochians or under the Seleucids, this proved to be utterly false because they were far worse off under Antiochus. At least, they were certainly worse off when Antiochus IV became king, as we shall see in the future. And so, that was verse 14, and we have at the end of verse 17, where it says, quote, "He shall give him the daughter in marriage, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither before him," end quote. Antiochus III thought that he would emulate Alexander the Great's conquest. He had reestablished the Seleucid Empire over the whole east, but he didn't have the territory that Alexander had come from, Macedonia. So he wanted to make his situation safe with Egypt, and so he made a peace agreement with Ptolemy. Antiochus III gave Cleopatra, his daughter, to Ptolemy in marriage. in marriage, thinking that she, as Queen of Egypt, would give his support to him, but she didn't. Daniel says, quote, "But she shall not stand on his side, and neither before him," end quote. There was a great disappointment for him when Cleopatra threw her whole loyalty to her husband rather than to her father. But she was the first Egyptian to bear the name Cleopatra. And then in verse 18, it says here, quote, "After this, he shall turn his face into the isles and shall take many," end quote. And we know that Antiochus III turned westward, north and westward. He already held most of Asia Minor, which the Seleucids had held for a century and a half before. Now he marched across into Europe and began seizing territory in Europe. And he was quite successful in seizing Macedonia, the territory to the north, and much of Greece. And then he got a message from Rome, and the Roman representative said to him, "We want you to stop trying to make conquests in Europe." And Antiochus replied, "Look, I don't interfere in Italy. I don't interfere in your region. What right do you have to interfere with what I'm doing back here?" And so the Romans, whether they had any right or not, they had the might. And they sent an army which defeated Antiochus and drove him back out of Europe, and then followed him into Asia Minor and defeated him at the great battle at Magnesia. And so verse 19 says, quote, "To be seen no more," end quote. This is a very brief summary of what happens when the Romans, after driving him out of Greece, after their great victory, followed him into Asia Minor. And there in Asia Minor, they fought a great battle at Magnesia, and as a result of this battle, the Romans completely defeated Antiochus III, and when he was thus completely defeated, the Romans made him pay the whole cost of their expedition. The reparation was for all that had cost them to send the expedition from Rome. Antiochus III had promised to pay a large sum of money each year for the next 12 years and give them 20 of his leading supporters, including his own sons, to go to Rome and live there as hostages, guaranteeing Antiochus's good behavior. And so, this complete and utter defeat of Antiochus III completely ruined the great glory that he had gotten after 35 years of hard fighting. And it is summarized here in Daniel, quote, "To be seen no more," end quote. Now, this word stumble is interesting. It doesn't suggest that he is killed in war. It doesn't suggest that he dies in his bed. It doesn't suggest there is an uprising. What happens was that in trying to pay these heavy reparations to the Romans, Antiochus went eastward in order to loot the temples of various deities, and he came into a little temple of a small tribe that he looked on with utter contempt, but he knew they had considerable treasure in their temple. He had taken treasure from temples of various deities, why not this one? So he went into this one, and he was getting careless, and the local guardians got excited and killed him. He stumbled and fell. He was killed in such a minor little temple. A man who carried on such tremendous, successful war was killed in this tiny temple. And so that is what is said about Antiochus III in 11 verses, and then we have listed Seleucus IV in verse 20. Because it is a very interesting fact that we have only one verse about Seleucus IV, but this verse shows such a remarkable contrast to Antiochus III. Seleucus IV, his oldest son, succeeded him, and the kingdom was in pretty bad shape because they had to pay those heavy reparations to the Romans, and they had so many of their leaders in Rome as hostages. And so we read, quote, "They shall stand up in his estate and raise taxes in the glory of the king," end quote. The glory of his great war expeditions was gone, and all he could do was try to get money together to pay the indemnities and to get in good shape again. And so, Seleucus IV reigned for 11 years. He got no glory, but he did get the government on a good fiscal base again by raising taxes and getting things organized in the kingdom. But then we read, quote, "But only for a few days," end quote. And compared to Antiochus III's reign from 233 to 187 BC, 11 years seems like but a few days. We read again, "But within a few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle." End quote. Now, how are you destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle? His chief minister made a plot against him and murdered him, and so he was destroyed, quote, neither in anger nor in battle, end quote. His chief minister, who destroyed him that way, tried then to reign in the name of his infant son. He had an older son who was a hostage in Rome. But in the name of the infant son, the chief minister tried to reign, but he didn't succeed for very long. And the next ruler is so important from a biblical standpoint that I am giving him another heading in the outline, capital D, and this is Antiochus IV, also called Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, he's given 15 verses here, and in the history of Judaism, he is one of the most important rulers. Why is he important to Israel? Because he was not simply a man who wanted conquest, though he did. He wasn't a man who simply caused trouble for the Jews, which he did. He was a man who tried to wipe out the Jewish religion entirely. Antiochus IV, towards the latter part of his reign, set himself to attempt to completely destroy the Jewish religion. He forced the Jews to become pagan. He tried first to be nice to them and to give them all kinds of favors, to the ones at least who had turned pagan, and many did. But some of the Jews were very strong against Antiochus, and then he proceeded with extremely harsh measures against them, and the religion of the Old Testament, humanly speaking, would have been completely wiped out except for a priest who resisted Antiochus's efforts to force the people to sacrifice to Zeus. Now here's the history. In a little town of Modiin, which is a bit northwest of Jerusalem, a priest by the name of Mattathias and his sons resisted Antiochus's efforts. Mattathias and his sons fled into the wilderness, and they became such good guerrilla fighters that they came to be called, quote, the Hammers, end quote, or, quote, the Maccabees, end quote. Maccabee in Hebrew means the hammer, and soon others joined, and eventually they gained their freedom completely from Antiochus IV. Now, number two in the outline is Antiochus's career, and in order to understand something of this crisis that occurred at this time, it is necessary to know something about this man, Antiochus IV. Antiochus IV was, as you know from your chart here, he was the second son of Antiochus III. Antiochus IV was a hostage in Rome. We don't know for how long he lived there, but he lived there long enough to become very familiar with Roman customs, situations, and methods of doing things. And then he was released from being a hostage in Rome, and Seleucus III's oldest son, who became known as Demetrius, was made hostage in Rome, and Antiochus was allowed to leave. Antiochus went to Greece and lived there, and he lived in Athens and became an important official in the Athenian government. I have even heard that he was called a mayor. I'm not sure exactly what the title meant at that time or what position that entailed, but he was very successful in Athens. Now, Antiochus IV had no right to become king because Demetrius, who was the oldest son of Seleucus III, he's the one who should have been king, but he was a hostage in Rome in place of Antiochus IV. But then, when Seleucus, his oldest brother, was killed, Antiochus immediately got in touch with some people in Asia Minor who had considerable funds, and Antiochus got them to fund him to try to become king of the Seleucid Empire. And he came with a small force into Asia Minor, and he managed to get support with all kinds of promises and flattery, so he became king after his brother's death, and also then killed his brother's infant son. That seems to be a pattern, doesn't it? And so, in verse 21 of chapter 11, we read, "In his estate shall stand up a vile person, whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and claim the kingdom by flatteries," end quote. And so Antiochus thus secured control there, and he reigned from 176 to 64 BC. Now, he was a man with very peculiar characteristics. He called himself Epiphanes. Now, Epiphanes refers to a feast in many Christian denominations. It is called the Feast of the Epiphany. It's the Feast of the Appearance of the Lord, for Epiphanes means appearance. But when Antiochus IV called himself Epiphanes, he was claiming to be a god on earth. He was the outshining god, and so he called himself Antiochus Epiphanes. But he began, when he first came to Antioch, to go around soliciting votes to become king, acting as if it was a democratic position, and looking for votes, which he had done in Athens. And he went from one extreme to the other in his reign. He would be a tyrant who killed people on the slightest whim, and then he would turn around and do all kinds of things for people and act in a way as if he was one of the commonest of all people in the empire. And he was very unpredictable, but one thing he wanted was unity in his kingdom. He wanted everyone to worship him as a god and to worship the gods he had worshipped. His brother had gathered considerable funds by this time, so Antiochus set out to build a new temple to Zeus in Athens, and he built a tremendous temple, in fact, one of the greatest temples in Athens. Yet he was unable to complete it in his own lifetime, and it remained incomplete for 200 years, and then a Roman emperor completed this great temple, again one of the largest temples in Athens. After a time, Antiochus saw his sister Cleopatra, whom you know was the queen of Egypt, and when her husband died, there were two young boys, the oldest of whom was nominally king, though his ministers were actually ruling. Antiochus decided that he would try to take control over Egypt. And so there in Egypt, he made up with his nephew, who was nominally the king, and who was in his teens still at that time. The two of them ate together, and he thought he would rule Egypt through his nephew, now being the nominal king. His nephew talked as if he was going to do everything his uncle Antiochus wanted him to do, while his nephew, in actuality, was planning to throw off his uncle's control just as soon as he could. But we read here in verse 27 of Daniel that, quote, they told lies at one table, end quote. And that is, they sat eating together, lying to one another face to face. Now, the city of Alexandria was one of the great centers of Egypt, and Antiochus, however, was unable to get control of it, and he thought he would be able to establish his nephew as king and then control Alexandria through his nephew. So Antiochus went back to his own land, and on the way he stopped in Jerusalem in order to rob the temple. This brought him in sharp contact with the Jews, and he realized how opposed they were to his desire to make them all pagan. When he got back to Antioch, he held a tremendous celebration, and he invited people from all over the known world, and he spent tremendous sums of money on this lavish celebration in which he himself put on a great dance, and he himself did all kinds of things, mixing with the crowd in many different ways. Then he found out that his nephew in Egypt had thrown off all relationships with him and had declared himself entirely independent. And so Antiochus marched to Egypt to gain control with a large force, and he came down to Egypt and got practically all of Egypt under his control. And when he had it practically under his control, except for the city of Alexandria, which he was expecting soon to get control of, a ship arrived from Rome. The ship arrived, and he heard that there were important Roman officials on the ship, so he went down to the shore in order to greet them. And one of them had been a good friend of his when he had been in Rome. And Antiochus greeted him. Now, his friend's name was Gaius Popillus Lenus, and he said, "Hello, Gaius, it's so nice to see you." But Gaius didn't even smile, and he said to Antiochus, "I have a message for you from the Roman Senate." And Antiochus said, "Oh, great, that's fine. Let's have a good chat, let's have dinner together, and then I'll read the message from the Senate." But Gaius responded, "The message must be read right now." "Well," Antiochus said, "what's the message?" And Gaius took out the message, and he said, quote, "The Roman Senate declares that you must immediately leave Egypt and return to Asia and give up all attempts to conquer any part of Egypt, end quote. And Antiochus said, well, if that's the case, it will require some consideration on my time. Give me some time to consider it. And his friend took his staff, and he made a circle in the sand around where Antiochus was standing. And he said to Antiochus, quote, you can consider this as long as you stay inside of this circle, end quote. And when he said that, well, Antiochus was very familiar with the rising power of Rome, and having lived in Rome for some years, Antiochus considered briefly what he would do, and he said, well, of course, then, I will comply with the Roman Senate. And he said, now, it's important, and it is serious, so let's come, let's have dinner together, let's have a drink, and these people, these two friends, who were so stern before, now became friendly again and cordial. But Antiochus was seething. He wasn't very happy at all with what had happened, so he went back up to his own land, and he was extremely upset after that. The Romans for years after that loved to tell the story of the incident of what happened in Egypt, and their power was recognized even as far as Egypt by Antiochus's abject surrender on this occasion. But when he got back, Antiochus was now determined that he was going to put an end to the attitude of the Jews. And so he began harshly persecuting them, trying to seize their copies of the scriptures, sending agents into all the little villages and forcing people to sacrifice to Jupiter. He went into the temple in Jerusalem, and in the temple he put up a statue of Zeus, a Greek god. And he forced the people to sacrifice to him, and to sacrifice swine's flesh on the Jewish altar. The persecution was very intense then. If you ever get a chance to read Longfellow's dramatic poem on the Maccabees, it gives a very good picture of the events that occurred then. It's a very beautiful picture. We used it once at one of our occasions, and we had at the very beginning of the school year, we read this many years ago. We went through the main parts of the poem. It is a very fine picture of the general course of events at this time. But after this persecution was well underway, Antiochus found that he was beginning to run out of money, and so he went east in order to recoup his fortune from some of the centers where there was a good deal of money available, and there he was taken on with a nervous illness, and he shortly died. But his young son became king for a brief time after him. The persecution against the Jews was continued, but the group of the Maccabees, which we mentioned before, fought and eventually they gained their independence. They made a treaty of mutual support with Rome, and the Jews were completely independent for about a century or more before the Romans finally took over what remained of the Seleucid Empire. And so Antiochus IV is a very vivid character and very dramatic character. And to him, the attack on Jerusalem was a comparatively small part of his activity, but it is important from the standpoint of Jewish history. It is something that would have meant a complete end to the Old Testament and a complete end to the teachings in it had it not been for the Maccabean uprising. When the Maccabees began gaining power, then other people joined in with them who were not so interested in much more than their religious freedom. But the Maccabees were interested not only in religious freedom, they were interested in political freedom. And eventually the descendants of the Maccabees ruled independently, but fell very far short of the standard with which they had begun. And so these later descendants are not remembered with great favor among the Jews. But at any rate, this was the greatest crisis perhaps in the history of the religion of Israel prior to the time of Jesus Christ. And so Antiochus IV is so important in this regard, and it is important to see in Daniel chapter 11, verses 21 to 35, that we have the events described accurately. If you read through these verses, you will see how many of the things I have suggested are there. Now, the assignment for next time is posted on the board, and I will see you next time, Lord willing. This is the end of Lecture 11 of the Prophecies of Daniel.